in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program features an interview from the Morning Show archives with someone who was a frequent and much appreciated guest on the Morning Show, including back in the days when this program was hosted by Bill Guy. His name, Professor Don Cummings, who was for 36 years a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and one of the nation's most renowned experts on the great Walt Whitman. Just a little information about Professor Cummings before we hear this interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2006. Don Cummings was born in 1940 in Lafayette, Indiana, and went to Purdue University to earn a Bachelor of Arts in Creative Writing as well as a Master's in English. He ultimately earned his Ph.D. in English and American Studies from Indiana University. His teaching career actually began as a teaching assistant at his alma mater, Purdue University, and he taught at a couple of other colleges before beginning his 36-year term at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in 1970. Professor Cummings won a number of teaching awards during his time as Parkside, the most significant of which came in 1997 when he was named Wisconsin Professor of the Year by the Carnegie Foundation. He is also fondly remembered as a co-founder, along with Norm Coulter, of Parkside's highly regarded foreign film series, which is still going strong after all these years. Professor Cummings wrote four books about his favorite poet, Walt Whitman. The first, Walt Whitman, 1940 to 1975, a reference guide. The second, Approaches to Teaching Whitman's Leaves of Grass. The third, Walt Whitman, an Encyclopedia, for which Professor Cummings served as co-editor. And finally, the book which is discussed in today's interview, A Companion to Walt Whitman. Professor Cummings not only studied and taught about the poetry of others, but was also a gifted poet himself. And if you would like to explore his poetry, you should seek out a lovely book called The Open Road Trip, in which Professor Cummings published 20 of his own poems that explored in various ways his experiences as a world traveler, often with his second wife, Patricia, at his side. Here, then, is what turns out to be the final interview I did with Professor Cummings on the Morning Show. And this was done in 2006, not long before he retired from UW-Parkside as one of the most beloved members of their faculty. Enjoy. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm sorry, we're having some technical trouble with the replay of this interview. Please stand by.
Or leader.
That's Daniel Markey. He's a senior advisor.
All right, here is the interview itself with Professor Don Cummings. Again, this interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2006. I'm very pleased and honored for the next few minutes to be sitting opposite a longtime professor of English at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, Don Cummings, who has also been, over the years, a repeated guest on the morning show and certainly spoke with WGTD's Bill Guy on any number of occasions. He joins me today on the program to talk about what I am assuming is his most recent book. I'm pretty certain about that. It is called A Companion to Walt Whitman, and it is from Blackwell Publishing out of Oxford, England, and it helps us understand the importance and great influence of Walt Whitman, one of the most important figures of the 19th century, and someone whose work has had great resonance long after his death in 1892. Professor Cummings, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
Really glad to have you here. I have a feeling that a substantial book like this is the kind of labor of love that is not born overnight. Just how long and deep and broad a project is a book like this?
Well, this book actually took me a little less time than I thought it might. I believe from the time that I began my first activity toward producing the book until it came out in print, it was about 3 years. The book before this one, the Walt Whitman Encyclopedia, took four years and 3 months or something of that sort. So this one, almost as long as the encyclopedia, took less time for some reason. I'm not sure why, but maybe everything.
Well, you've certainly been living with Mr. Whitman's poetry for a long time. When did you first find your interest ignited? When and why and how?
Well, that's a tough question for me to answer. I began with an interest in American poetry, and I began with an interest in writing my own poetry. And somehow in pursuing those two interests, I kept stumbling upon Whitman. If you combine that circumstance with the fact that I took a seminar in graduate school at Indiana University devoted entirely to Whitman, and then eventually wrote a doctoral dissertation that involved writing two chapters on Whitman, it seems that I just kept coming across his work all of the time and getting further and further into it. I don't know when I decided, you know, that Whitman was sort of my area, my subject. What I recall at Parkside, when I came to Parkside in the early 1970s, there was a guy in the English department there by the name of Ronald Gottesman. He was one of the editors of the Norton Anthology of American Literature. He was also a guy who was a field editor for a series of books published by G.K. Hall. Hall at Parkside, when I came to Parkside in the early 1970s, there was a guy in the English department there by the name of Ronald Gottesman. He was one of the editors of the Norton Anthology of American Literature. He was also a guy who was a field editor for a series of books published by G.K. Hall in Boston. He asked me one day if I would be interested in doing a book for him in the series that he was editing. And I said, well, yeah, I might be. Let me think about it. So I remember talking to him maybe a week after he posed this question to him, and I went in and suggested that I'd be willing to do a book for him on the poet William Carlos Williams.
He said something to the effect, damn it, Don, I just sent out the contract on William Carlos Williams, so you're going to have to select somebody else.
Hmm.
So I remember going home and rethinking this and looking at, you know, what I had done over the past 5 or 6 years, and I realized that I had done the most work on Whitman. So I said, what about taking on Walt Whitman as one of the topics for a book? Well, it turned out that Ron Gottesman was doing or editing 20th century authors, and the 19th century author, field editor rather, was a guy by the name of Herschel Parker out at the University of Southern California. So Gottesman put me in touch with Herschel Parker. I got the contract to do the book on Walt Whitman. And, you know, once I had a book on Whitman, then that led to a second book on Whitman. And the contract to do the book on Walt Whitman. And, you know, once I had a book on Whitman, then that led to a second book on Whitman and a third. And now this, a companion to Whitman, is the fourth book I've done on Whitman.
So you didn't just go from Williams to Whitman because it was contiguous in the alphabetical listings of great poets. Huh?
No, I didn't do that.
Good.
But I didn't begin exactly, you know, with great enthusiasm for Whitman. I liked him well enough. I mean, I sensed even then that he was certainly, if not the greatest American poet, he was among the greatest American poets. You know, I liked him well enough to get involved in, you know, a big project on him. I would guess that from the time that I first began serious work on Whitman until now, I'm sure my view of Whitman, my understanding of him, has grown immeasurably.
Hmm.
I'm sure I have a far different sense of him now than I did at the beginning.
Help us understand, and I'm asking this as someone who really has not studied poetry very much over the years, for whatever reason. So I think for me, and probably for a number of our listeners, it's maybe hard for us to understand what a poetry scholar does with someone like Walt Whitman. I mean, such a well-known figure, already so studied, so thoroughly examined.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, I guess I'm asking, what is the untrod ground that remains to explore, or isn't it that? I mean, is it possible to go back to poems that have been examined many, 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 many times over and find something new to say about them?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, in some respects, yes, Whitman has been well investigated, much written upon, as probably as much written upon as any poet in American literature. But he's been around long enough now to have undergone various epochs, I guess, or eras of interpretation. I mean, the view of Whitman in 1920 or 1930 or 1940 or 1960, these different views tell us a lot about how our interpretations of authors change and evolve over time. I mean, in the 1930, Whitman was much liked by the radical political poets of that era and thought to be a person who spoke for the working poor and the oppressed masses and so on and so forth. In the 1940s, during World War and carried by American troops during World War II. In the 1960s, Whitman was perceived essentially as a kind of an early or a precursor, I guess you could say, of the beatnik poets and the bohemian poets of the 1960s. You know, Leaves of Grass was even associated with marijuana and grass, I suppose, in the 1960s. In more recent days, Whitman has been touted by quite a few people in the field of study, American literary study, as a great gay poet and the first to articulate a kind of gay sensibility. And
So, you know, things are always changing in the study of Whitman, and new views of his work are coming along. And, you know, so in a sense, he's not exhaustible in many ways, it seems to me.
I guess part of it then is you're not just studying Walt Whitman, the man, and his poetry, but you are studying the way in which his poetry, and the poetry of others for that matter, have been received and understood and discussed over the years. And I suppose, and we haven't even touched on how he has influenced other great poets in his wake.
Well, he's influenced a great many poets without question. Not everyone, of course, has liked Whitman. I mean, some fairly big names in the 20th century, notably T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, did not particularly like Whitman. But then they didn't particularly like, democratic ideology, you know, which Whitman represents. So, I mean, that's not that surprising. But, you know, what I've discovered over the years in reading Whitman, I found out so much more about 19th century America than I ever knew, because he absorbed and transformed in his poetry the goings-on of 19th century America. It's fascinating to me to discover in his work, for instance, his interest in phrenology, you know, the pseudoscience that involved people examining your skull and the America. It's fascinating to me to discover in his work, for instance, his interest in phrenology, you know, the pseudoscience that involved people examining your skull and the protuberances on your head and making assessments of your personality based on the shape of your head. It seems very unlikely that a great world-class poet might be interested in such stuff, but he was. And indeed, there are many references in Leaves of Grass to this kind of thing. Or another interesting aspect to me of Whitman's work, I know that you've had a lot of involvement with music. Well, Whitman was a great lover of music. He was especially fond of, at first at least, of Native American music. He liked sentimental singers like the Cheney family or the Hutchinson family, both New England singing family groups. He liked sentimental ballads. He liked the music of Stephen Foster and so on and so forth. Initially, he did not like opera. In fact, he has a statement or two in which he complained about things like ear-piercing shrieks and gurgling and death rattles and whatnot, and he thought this kind of music was unsuitable to an emerging democratic country and so on. But something somehow happened to Whitman, and he became one of the great lovers of opera, especially Italian opera. He loved Bellini and Donizetti and Verdi, and of course he was at a bit of an advantage because he lived much of his life there in New York City, and New York City probably attracted almost all of the great singers and opera companies of that era. So he saw firsthand, you know, all of the major players of the day. And he even went so far as to say at one point that had it not been for grand opera, he could not have written Leaves of Grass. Well, this kind of stuff, you know, about phrenology and the music of that era and, you know, various other things, the emerging visual culture of the era. You know, Whitman's career almost coincides with the emergence of photography. And he was very much interested in photography, and he also ended up being probably one of the most photographed people of his century. And, you know, he studied photography a little bit and reflected on its meanings. Indeed, saw it as a kind of democratic medium. You know, it didn't discriminate. It brought everything into the picture and so on. But, you know, I guess what I'm suggesting is that as I've got more and more into Whitman over the years, I've found out more and more about the United States and, you know, how it evolved and developed and how our own century connects with some of the things back in that era.
So to study Walt Whitman is to very much study his time. And I suppose that's not always true or not always true to that same extent. I mean, you think of a figure maybe like Emily Dickinson, mm-hmm. who lived in, at least to some extent, kind of a cloistered experience.
Right.
To study her life is not to engage with her time and place in quite the same way.
No, I don't think it is. You know, there have been a few critics of Emily Dickinson who have said, well, she was immersed in her era as well. She was immersed in this sense, I think. You know, to study her work is to understand New England or Massachusetts culture of the 19th century a little bit. But she certainly doesn't have the national sweep that Whitman did. And she really has very little to say, for instance, about the Civil War or huge events that went on in that time as well. So. She's not the figure I would turn to, you know, for a look at the culture of the day. But
Whitman engages all of that more directly.
Well, he certainly did.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Don Cummings, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and we're talking about the poet Walt Whitman. Professor Cummings has just produced a magnificent new book called A Companion to Walt Whitman. We have talked a bit about when he lived. He was born in 1819. He dies in 1892. So that's an intriguing lifespan, which includes a lot of the most important events of growth for our country. I understand that he had a very personal sort of encounter in the Civil War, which was really a life-changing event for him.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that and the ongoing influence for him.
Well, he did not enlist in the Civil War or fight in the Civil War. In fact, when the Civil War broke out, Whitman was, I think, about 41 years of age. However, he did have a younger brother by the name of George who did enlist in the Civil War and went off, and not long into the war was listed in the newspapers in New York City as having been wounded in battle. The newspaper did not give any indication of the severity of the wound. However, it did give enough information so that Whitman decided to travel to the Washington, D.C. area and to the countryside of Virginia to try to locate his brother George and to find out what he could do to help. So he left New York City, went to Washington, and then found his way to one of the encampments in Virginia, located his brother, discovered that his brother was not seriously wounded. He had been shot through the cheek, but it turned out to be a relatively minor wound. In any case, even that brief experience on the Civil War battlefields, also his experience in seeing all of the makeshift hospitals that had been set up there in Washington, D.C., had a profound experience, a profound influence on Whitman. He decided that he would stay on and see what he could contribute to the needs of the soldiers. you know, for instance, one of the things that he saw when he went out into Virginia was an army tent, a hospital tent, where surgeries were performed. outside this tent was a rather large pile of human limbs that had been amputated from soldiers. I gather that the state of medicine during the Civil War was certainly primitive. The state of anesthesia, as far as I know, was, also primitive. As far as I can tell, amputation was often the first rather than the last resort. Also, soldiers in the Civil War, both North and South, I guess, were so young and young-looking to Whitman that, initially he had been an ardent supporter of the Northern cause, but once seeing the suffering that occurred for these soldiers, both North and South, he decided to stay on in Washington, D.C., find himself some employment, which he did by working in several government offices, and he went to these hospitals and ministered to the soldiers for 2 or 3 years. What he did evidently was to come and simply sit with them, read to them, bring them little gifts of candy or tobacco, write letters for them. Evidently, he even assisted occasionally in a minor way in some of the surgeries that were performed. But he became, in effect, a volunteer nurse. And often if these soldiers died, he would be the one who ended up writing to the parents, telling the parents how their son died, how his last moments were, and tried to provide whatever consolation he could. So there was something very self-sacrificing about this effort on Whitman's part. Later he's going to be accused by a guy by the name of Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a prominent editor and critic of the day. Whitman was accused of not fighting in the war. He was still young enough to fight, and why wasn't he, especially since he seems to have had opinions on the war, strong opinions, and so on and so forth. Well, I don't know, at 41 years old, I don't know how much of a soldier, a battlefield soldier you can really, really be. Besides, given what he did do in contributing to the to the national catastrophe, I think it's an unfair charge that he didn't fight in the war. But he did not fight in the war.
Tell us his sort of political persuasion and the way that he saw the world, and especially the way in which he saw his own country.
I think initially, when he first began as an editor for newspapers, and he began writing poetry, and he wrote short fiction for a while. He also wrote any number of editorials for New York City and Brooklyn newspapers. He was quite a political person at the outset, involved in local political elections and the like, and going to political conventions. I think when he began his work on Leaves of Grass and he published that first edition, he was far less openly political in his life. His politics sort of went into the book Leaves of Grass. What his politics were exactly, I've been reflecting on this recently because I'm writing a little encyclopedia entry on Whitman on this topic. He was, in some ways, a kind of political moderate, as he developed his book of poetry there. you tend to think of Whitman as being radical politically, and there are things in Leaves of Grass that suggest that, but he didn't like, for instance, the abolitionists particularly. He had he didn't like, for instance, the abolitionists particularly. And, you know, he had abolitionist friends who were always trying to recruit him to their cause. But he didn't like political causes that he thought pretended social disorder. He didn't like anything that suggested to him that might lead to the dismantling of the Constitution or the violation of the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence or something. So, you know, he was sympathetic with all kinds of different causes. I mean, he had women friends, you know, in the women's 19th century women's movement. He was very sympathetic to their cause, but he never became a full-blooded subscriber to the cause. He was recruited by the Free Love Society in the 19th century America, but he never became a subscriber to that cause. Toward the end of his life, he was very close friends with a guy by the name of Horace Traubel, an ardent socialist. Traubel tried to get Whitman to admit that basically his philosophy was that of socialism, but Whitman refused to do it. He wouldn't commit himself evidently to any kind of social position. So he always thought that these kinds of things were partial in their efforts to reform society. Also, he worried about the potential destructiveness of anything that was carried to an extreme. So, meanwhile, in Leaves of Grass, he evolved over time, I think, what you would call a radical democratic position. He really strongly, adamantly believed in a democratic outlook on life. And, I think essentially that's his political position.
When we look at Walt Whitman's poetry, how directly do we see his views on some of what you've just been talking about, or is it something that we discern more by kind of reading between the lines or behind the words?
I think it's more of a reading between the lines or reading, knowing something of the background of his life. He's not especially doctrinaire, it seems to me. At least when I read his work, you know, it's hard to point to any particular passage to Walt Whitman's view. In fact, one of the interesting things about the book Leaves of Grass, and maybe confusing things for people who don't know that much about Whitman, is that he speaks in this first-person voice quite often. He even refers to himself in his poetry by name. He calls himself Walt Whitman. But clearly, the guy called Walt Whitman in Leaves of Grass is not the same guy known by that name in real life in 19th century America. They were two different people. The persona created in Leaves of Grass is I think, wilder, more flamboyant than the actual Walt Whitman. I think the actual Walt Whitman was a kind of reclusive guy, kind of retiring in ways, quieter, less boisterous than the persona of Leaves of Grass. So,
you mentioned the fact that in the 1970s, Walt Whitman became a very important figure and inspiring figure, actually, for the gay liberation movement. Let's talk for a moment about what we know about who Walt Whitman himself was, and then the way in which he went on to be this inspiring figure.
Well, this is an interesting topic to me in some respects, because I think my own sense of Whitman has changed in that regard over the years, and I suspect what that indicates is that I myself have changed. I can remember being in this graduate seminar on Whitman at Indiana University in the late 1960s. And we had to write several papers in this seminar. We had to give an oral report in the seminar. We also had to have a little discussion, a little private discussion, as I remember, an interview with the professor of the class. And I remember this instructor asked me in this little interview, I can't remember how he phrased the question exactly, but he wanted to know what my opinion was of whether or not Whitman was gay. And I remember I said to him basically, well, you know, this seems to me a kind of charge for which there's little evidence, you know. I remember taking umbrage to some extent at this idea that Whitman might be gay. You know, I hope I didn't say at the time anything particularly homophobic. I don't think I did, but, you know, it seemed to me to be, at the time, a negative charge against Whitman. Later, of course, when I become far more involved in the study of Whitman and reading about Whitman and reading the comments made on Whitman by gay critics and so on and so forth, I developed a far different view of this whole question. And, you know, here's what I think nowadays. If you read Whitman's poetry carefully, I think there's no question whatsoever that he celebrated sexuality in all of its forms. Not just heterosexuality or homosexuality, but autoeroticism and bisexuality. I mean, there's just no doubt that all of this is in the poetry. You can find it particularly in a group of poems called the Calamus Poems. You can find his celebrations of sexuality in Children of Adam poems and Song of Myself and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, that's one thing. Now, what was Whitman in his actual life? What was his sexual orientation? That's a tougher question. That's a different question in many ways. There have been times, I think, when I've been involved in one of these book projects on Whitman, when I've had no doubt that he probably was a gay person. There have been other times when I felt that he was a bisexual person. There have also been times when I felt that here's a guy who talked a lot about sexuality but may well not have had any sexual experiences in his life. You know, it's hard to know about this for certain, because there seems to be little evidence one way or another about his actual sexual orientation. What I find really interesting in all of this is that he lived in a time when, and even died, in fact, before the term homosexual came into the vocabulary, before the term gay was ever applied to someone of his sensibility. I find that interesting. So, you know, he was perhaps attempting to articulate a gay sensibility before people even had any awareness of such an outlook or such a personality or such a sexual orientation. I find that kind of interesting. Hmm. It's yet another that has become much discussed and much debated and has caused reformulations of how we think about this guy.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. I mean, it's one thing in 2006 for, let's say, a young man or a young woman to maybe realize this about themselves and trying to come to terms with it, but at least it's in a world and in a culture where at least there's a terminology with which one can talk about it and some sense of who you might go and talk to or how you might right. think of this and express it. But it's quite another thing to imagine what someone like a Walt Whitman was doing in trying to come to terms with this.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that has struck me increasingly over the years is how this writer managed to find the courage to put sexuality as a topic, as a subject, into his poetry at a time when to make any public utterance, as one of the essayists in the book says, at a time when
to make any public utterance about sexuality was to invite criticism and ostracism and the like. And yet Whitman managed to make sexuality a kind of centerpiece of this book, Leaves of Grass. How or why he would do that and had the courage to do that, I don't know, but it's an interesting aspect of his life and work, in my view.
We should take our closing minutes, and I wish there was more time for us to do this. We should talk a bit about what sets his poetry aside as distinctive. What do you most appreciate about Walt Whitman's poetry?
Well, I guess I've always admired free verse poetry at least as much, if not more, than regular rhyming or metrical poetry. I've also admired in Whitman his attention to detail, his vivid images, at least in poems like Song of Myself. You know, his attention to detail and particularity seemed to me to have provided a course or a direction for American poetry that is even more prominent in the 20th century. You know, when you get into the 20th century, a lot of people look back to Whitman and found him quite influential in the style of poetry and the law. Now, provided a course or a direction for American poetry that is even more prominent in the 20th century. You know, when you get into the 20th century, a lot of people look back to Whitman and found him quite influential in the style of poetry and the law. Now, there are some things about Whitman that 20th century poets, I think, didn't like. You know, the upbeat, optimistic, affirmative tone of much of the poetry, I don't think they particularly liked or saw as applicable. Also, I don't think some poets liked the kind of exhortation, the tone of exhortation, you know, the didactic quality of some of the poetry. I don't think 20th century poets often have liked that. And yet, there's a great deal in his poetry that has appealed to people, especially, you know, maybe his poems that make use of imagistic techniques that 20th century poets are going to take much further than Whitman did. All these kinds of things I tend to like. Whitman is certainly not the only poet, however, that I have liked. I mean, there are other poets and other styles of poems that I admire, and I think given what Whitman did, you know, back in the 19th century, I'm still impressed by some of the breakthroughs that he made. And you know, you have to keep in mind that when Whitman came along, American literature was still pretty much imitative of British literature, especially the poetry. You know, you had poets in mid-19th century America still writing about birds like cuckoos and linnets, not native to, you know, to this continent, or writing about flora and fauna that were familiar to British readers, not so much American readers. Well, you know, Whitman changed the whole scene and truly started to write about American topography and American culture and American ideas, and you know, that makes him, in my book, really an interesting guy.
Yeah. And at the time that he was writing, for instance, in free verse, I mean, kind of casting off some of the what had been for such a long time kind of the prescriptive meter and so on, was that relatively common, or was he among a rather select few poets who were writing in kind of a daring new style?
It was not at all common. He was not the inventor of free verse. In fact, you know, one of his important models was the Bible, where you do have great passages of his important models was the Bible, where you do have great passages of free verse in the Song of Songs and Ecclesiastes and elsewhere. There were other people in British lit. There were a few British poets who had written some free verse poems, but Whitman was so prominent in this regard that he's often taken to have invented free verse, but he did not do that. But he certainly introduced American poetry to this style of verse, and in the 20th century, free verse has become virtually the dominant style, I would say.
Do you have a favorite poem of Walt Whitman?
Gee, I don't. I suppose my favorite poem would be the longest one, "Song of Myself," it's called. A poem that initially he gave no title to, and it appeared in the first edition of Leaves of Grass in 1855. It's always been sort of the centerpiece of every subsequent edition of Leaves of Grass. When he reprinted it in 1856, he gave the poem the title Walt Whitman. Now I've forgotten the title. An American Poet or something of the sort. Then he shortened that later on to Walt Whitman, and then finally near the end of his career, he changed the title of the poem to "Song of Myself." It's a poem I like a lot, I guess, because it seems to me to have the essential Whitman in it. You know, his great energy and zest and colorfulness and, you know, some of the most striking lines in all of his poetry, and some of the most famous lines in all of his poetry are contained in it. For example, you know, he proclaims near the end of the poem, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes," he says. Also, he has in that poem the line, "I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world," a line often taken to mean that here's a new world upstart democratic poet who's going to vie with the great poets of the past, including Shakespeare. Only Whitman is not going to give silver-tongued my favorite poem in Whitman.
Is there something shorter you could read to finish out our program? I didn't warn you about that.
No, you didn't.
Sorry.
I might, if I can find it quickly, read you a little poem I've always rather liked, although it doesn't seem necessarily characteristic.
I'll let you go looking while I reiterate that the book we've been talking about primarily today through the course of this interview, Professor Cumming's most recent book about Walt Whitman, called A Companion to Walt Whitman, a rather imposing book recently published by Blackwell Publishing out of Oxford, England, one of three or four different books which Professor Cummings has produced about this extraordinarily gifted and important American poet, Walt Whitman. And it looks like you are getting close to...
I think I'm getting close to finding this. Yes, I did find it. It's a short poem entitled "I Sit and Look Out." An interesting little poem that gives you a glimpse of Whitman's stoicism, I guess you could say. It has to do with some of the terrible things that go on in the world, his day and our own day, I guess. The title of the poem is "I Sit and Look Out." "I sit and look out upon all the sorrows of the world and upon all oppression and shame. I hear secret convulsive sobs from young men at anguish with themselves,
remorseful after deeds done. I see in low life the mother misused.